significant little straws in the wind here. Let's see, Belo Horizonte, Brazil. An avalanche of garbage from the city dump crashed down into the town and killed four people yesterday. That's how, I'm not actually laughing, but the idea of being buried under a fantastic avalanche of garbage sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it, huh? Bring up their large herd, please. So man's plight continues as he marches ever upward on the eternal struggle to the top of the pyramid, wherever the hell that is. And not only that, fellow victims, an Australian housewife who claims that she is being driven neurotic by her neighbor's duck has filed a writ with the Victorian Supreme Court in Australia seeking an injunction to restrain the duck's owners from allowing it to quack. It's been quacking continuously and somewhat obscenely, and it's driving the entire family over the edge. The complainant, Mrs. Judith McGindle, alleges that its quacking has already forced her and her two children to seek psychiatric help for nervous disorders. We'd like to salute that duck tonight. He's only doing his thing and probably saying stuff I don't know whether you've ever lived next door to a duck. It doesn't matter whether you have or not. The question is, of course, academic. And so many things are academic today. We'd like to salute the academic concepts, if we may, tonight. And you'll notice that there's a certain snotty quality to my voice tonight. You notice that? Well, it's because it's just the way it is. It's the beginning of the Christmas season, and already I'm getting nervous about that whole thing. This is the time, of course, when slob art is at its absolute finest. Herb, please, on the other disc that I brought in, that is another disc there, please. I brought another one down. Give me something that's somewhat a pompous, Herb. Something has a little pomposity to it, please. That won't be hard, will it? All right, this is the age when pomposity has become a major commodity. Have you ever noticed the fantastic concern on John Chancellor's face when he's saying anything? That I think is just saying anything, just like saying good night. He has a fantastic, just a tremendous presence, an official quality to him that none of us have been able in most of our private lives to accomplish. To walk into a house and walk into a living room and be like a walking statue. Can you imagine sitting down to breakfast with Walter Cronkite and he's digging into the Wheaties? No, you can't. You just can't, because he doesn't have Wheaties. He doesn't absorb the ordinary things of our lives. He marches on a higher plane. And I am going to tonight abjure you to do the same thing. Look deep into your navel. Down there where all that lint has been gathering. Down there where all those little feathers in your navel have been slowly accumulating. Did you hear about the guy in Chillicothe who 2 years ago had this great moment of triumph? In fact, he was saluted by many of the major magazines that after over 4 years of saving lint and little cruddlies from his navel, he finally was able to fill a small pillow with the result of endless naval cruddly saving. Now, this is not a small, and certainly not a small accomplishment, because it shows the persistence of mankind. Mankind persists. He hangs in. And by God, that's something you can't say for the dinosaurs and some of the lower reptiles who did not hang in. Even though they had bulk and weight and they had a big fat tail, everything going for them, they didn't hang in. But we did. So this pillow is not to be laughed at. Not at all. I mean, it's easy to you know, I say that this time of the year, which is, of course, as you know, rapidly approaching the Christmas period, already it's getting serious. If you haven't thought about it, it's getting damn serious. You better start thinking that it's coming on. And the frenzy is coming on. And in an affluent society, of course, Christmas time has become more of an orgiastic exchange of gigantic, ever-increasingly enormous gifts, generally with a great dollop of uselessness in them. The more useless the gift, the more symbolically important it is. So if you ever gave somebody, let's say, for example, a really useful gift, let's say you gave him a set of jockey shorts, I don't think that would cause much excitement. You know, it's, oh, jockey shorts. George, no way. But if you gave him a Japanese game designed to shoot ping pong balls in the air and flash colored lights every time three ping pong balls land simultaneously on a little symbolically painted painting on the glass that says Pearl Harbor, and then the bells go off and he wins the big gazookas, at that point, he would say, fantastic! This is great, groovy, wow! So this is the essence of an affluent society during Christmas time, which is, as I say, an orgiastic. Let's face it, there has never been a practical orgy. Think of an orgy itself. Is it practical? Of course not. I mean, it's not like waiting for a bus, which is a mass thing we all do. That's practical. Nobody gets... An orgy is a thing which is impractical. It's exciting, dangerous, can lead to all kinds of problems, fist fights, often ruin, rack, and all the rest of the problems, even in, occasionally gunshots pursue the trail of the serious orgiast. By the way, I suspect that eventually that will become an Olympic event, too. You know, this can't you see this elegant orgiast coming out? And Howard Cosell is standing by to report from Munich. And which brings me to a point. I there's a lot of little straws in the wind which don't seem to be particularly important. Nobody mentions them, but they're going on. For example, have you noticed increasingly the increasing madness of Howard Cosell worship in our land, which completely eluded, only a truly affluent society could afford that kind of nuttiness. I mean, that's aesthetic nuttiness, aesthetic affluence, really. And so when all other gods have failed, there's always Howard. And that fantastic toupee he's got, which is a work of art in itself. However, I was watching a football game the other night, and they kept picking up in the stands giant signs that the people were holding up. Hooray for Howard! Yeah, they were, and nobody said hooray for the Dallas Cowboys. Nobody's holding a sign up, you know, hooray for the San Francisco, whatever they are. You know, hooray for the Chargers, hooray for the Patriots. They were saying hooray for Howard, and down at the bottom, and also Dandy Dan, and not to forget the Fearless Frank. But hooray for Howard! That's what the football game was about. It was no longer about those poor guys clobbering their heads out there. It was about being in the same arena with Howard. And so man has always striven to reach Parnassus. He's always climbed up the sheer cliffs of Olympus to stand near the gods. He knows he'd never be one, but to stand near them. This is what the ball game is about. It always has. That's called the pilgrim syndrome. And so everywhere you look, you see it beginning to grow. And of course, Christmas time is when it gets its full flower, magnificent flower. For example, if you've been watching the developments in gifts lately, which I do every year, and I think it's part of my duty as an artist to record the passing phenomena. So 100 years from now, if they play these tapes, I say, my God, was it really like that? Yes, it was, friends. You guys, 150 years, 150 years from now, you couldn't believe how it was, because a lot of stuff we're burying, we're not even mentioning. We just hide it there under the rubble. And we don't mention it. For example, there's one television commercial which shows how magnificent the gifts have become. It comes on with this kind of pompous music. You see it on television. It's all misty. And you see a Christmas tree sort of misting there in the quiet, you know. Yes, you see the mist and the clouds of time are surrounding these little tiny balls of light. And you know instantly that you're in the presence of a Christmas commercial. And the voice of the announcer intones, and by the way, he is playing the role apparently of a father, a very affluent father, in this particular commercial. He says, an open letter to Janice. Janice, your mother and I want you to have a really Merry Christmas this year. Your mother and I love you very deeply, Janice. And then we see a quick shot of Janice with purple and green lights coming. And she's moving towards the Venetian blinds. And she's looking out on the street. And the voice says, "Yes, Janice. This Christmas, your mother and I decided to get you, now that you're 16, your first brand new automatic drive, wide track, multiple stereo equipped, magnificently air-conditioned, for your own, your very own, your new 1973 Vega. And out there with a ribbon tied over its hood is a blood-red Vega, symbolic, since blood-red has always been symbolic of sex in all of its manifestations. The sun glances off the hood, and Janice is overcome with emotion. And she's apparently looking at the instruction manual, which begins that this car has a warranty for over 7 days. It should not be attempted to be driven after 2 years due to the fact that it is a disposable machine. However, the voice continues, "We want you to know that we want you to have a great Christmas this year, Janice. But drive safely, Janice. We want the gift of life to be part of our world. Your mother and I love you, Janice. So drive your new Vega for Christmas and drive it well. Merry Christmas, Janice." My God, after you've got the new Vega for Christmas on your 16th year, where do you go from there? Don't give me any of this frankincense jazz. Who the hell needs mirror? Oh, come on, are you kidding? Partridges? Oh, pear trees? Oh, my God. Please, please, Vega. Fantastic. So tonight we salute. I can't tell who we salute. It boggles the imagination. No, it doesn't really. No. You can't boggle modern man's imagination. Hell no, I haven't been boggled in a long time. By the way, there's a great little boggle shop over on 44th Street. If you really want to get boggled, they'll boggle you. This is WOR New York. That is, until they close them all up. This is WOR New York, and let's see, we have a couple of little funnies here. Yeah, so do you have a little tapey in there for me, Herb, please? Oh, they're singing. Aren't they nice? It's one of our Christmas carols here on the station. As they dance around a Christmas tree wrapped in her beautiful, sexy-looking tires, here's a safe driving tip from General. Increase the air pressure in your tires to car manual recommendations for long trips. What do you mean, increase the air pressure to car manual recommendations? What's the guy got him set to now, I wonder? Anyway, here's another tip from General Tire. For a great tire at a low price, get the General Jet White Wall. And even if you don't have a car, it makes such a beautiful gift. It's nice and round and fat, and it smells good. And you can pile them up in your living room and make a coffee table out of them. It's General. Yeah, look for your General Tire headquarters. It's listed in the yellow pages. The beautiful new General White Wall Tire. It's a magnificent work of art. In the Slav division. I'll bet, you know, we laugh about that, though, but I'll bet within 100 years or so, guys will be collecting tires, because by then, 100 years, you know, there's going to have to be a lot of stuff happen. I mean, you know, things are changing, and will, you know, in 100 years. It's hard to comprehend what they'll be doing in 100 years, and what they actually will collect. Now, for example, have you ever gone up into places like Vermont and that? And people pay like $250 for an actual wagon wheel. Well, now, for God's sakes, wagon wheels probably sold for $2 a piece. I mean, at the general store. And now all of a sudden, you know, they're a fantastic collection. But do you realize that if you stockpiled old General Tires in your basement and held on, just a tip, you know, word to the wise. I mean, and I'm sure that you're wise. You wouldn't be listening to this show if you weren't. And assume that. Isn't it great to be one of the sensitive people? It really is. Just think you could have been born a real clod, you know, a real klutz. You could be a Cousin Brucey fan, all that stuff, you know? Walk around and buy this acne cream and, you know, yell. Go to McDonald's every night and say, "Hey, how about a cheeseburger, huh?" Yeah. A Gramercy Park close of 64 West 23rd Street in New York says, now that you've heard what Gramercy Park has done to the price of men's clothing, watch what happens to you. What is all this about? It says, every time you pass a suit in the factory store window, you'll ask yourself, I can't remember ever doing this. Yeah, can you remember ever asking yourself, hey, I wonder what a good-looking suit like that would cost at Gramercy Park? Now, that's a commercial problem. Have you noticed there's so many commercial problems? For example, they complain so much on television about tea stains in a sink. I have never noticed a tea stain in a sink, but it seems to be very big with Jane Withers, you know, the lady plumber. And then, in fact, they seem to talk about how tough it is to get dogs to eat. You notice they say that? Listen, I know dogs that have eaten entire coffee tables. I know one dog that ate four Castro convertibles, ate the wallpaper off the wall, started on the rug, and then finally ate four cases of Alpo that he found out in his sink. What is this business of not getting the dog to eat? I mean, that's one of those TV... But anyway, we'd like to suggest you go to Gramercy Park Close, 64 West 23rd Street. Third floor, 64 West 23rd Street. And you walk right in. Hey, wouldn't it be groovy if five of you guys walked in and then loudly says, hey, what is a good-looking suit like you doing in a place like this? And, you know, then turn around and walk out. Say, no, I wouldn't buy any suit that hangs around a place like this. Got to be something shifty about it. With the big iron gates they got up there at Gramercy Park, they close behind you, you know. It's just the iron gates. And, one more commercial we've got here before we let you off the hook. Since this is Christmas time, we'd like to add a little elegance to your meatloaf out there in Queens when you're going to have an elegant meal. Add a little touch of elegance to your life out there in Staten Island. If you'd like to enjoy fine French wines with your meals, but it's too complicated and expensive, you know, all that foreign writing on the labels and all that stuff. And, hey, what is this Medoc stuff, huh? Well, if you're one of those elegant Queens types, the Alexis Lachine Company selects the right wines for you, reds, whites, and rosé. And remember the name. Everybody, if you buy, these Alexis Lachine wines, everybody will be, you'll be referred to as a wine expert, you know, in your neighborhood. Hey, that's Jaime's, a wine expert. And, comes if you try the Alexis Lachine wines. Alexis Lachine is elegant quality without confusion. Alexis Lachine is imported by Bass Charrington Vintners of New York. Would you please sing?
Alexis.
While I light my candle here.
Alexis.
And pour my, I like these Alexis Rosie wines. It says Rosie on the front. They're good, yeah. They're kind of pink, you know. Go with a big boy burger. Very good. I'm sorry. Hey, you know, speaking of art forms, though, and as we were talking about, you know, the major slob art forms of our time, is of course one of the art forms that I don't think is really going to be recorded for posterity, is the Christmas window. I mean, somebody should be collecting these because 100 years from now they won't believe what they were like. You really looked at some of these windows? I'm talking about the ones along Fifth Avenue and 34th Street and all that. And, balloons in the shape of the Goodyear blimp, little professional football games. You can buy yourself now a little blow-up Howard Cosell, even. They're all out there in the windows, seeing everything is revolving and lights are going off and on. And it's a curious, surrealistic dream. And this is an art form. It really is. It expresses our time. In a curious way, the maniacal quality to it. And I dig it, by the way. So I'm not putting it down, because after all, I'm part of the scene. And I must admit I stand second to nobody in my love and my appreciation of Strawberry Diet Yoo-Hoo. It's part of our time. And you either do or you don't, you know. and I was watching football over the weekend. See, I turned on the TV set, and here, in full fantastic color, the halftime extravaganzas are getting more and more spectacular. Have you noticed that? And I'll tell you another thing. Somebody's going to have to change the nomenclature on them. For one thing, this great crowd of girls that come out on the football field no longer are drum majors or drum majorettes. They are a chorus line, an absolute total chorus line. I mean, they come out, their bazooms are going, the whole business, you know. I mean, it's the kind of stuff that guys used to get arrested for at the American Legion when they went to sea. And, you know, the bald head crowd. And there's a giant chorus line comes out with this thing. Now, there's all kinds of ramifications and other things that go on with it. But by that, I mean, it isn't only sex. And anybody who thinks it's sexual sublimation, I don't think so. I think it's a panorama that is curiously attuned to a lot of very, very subterranean things in all of us as Americans. It's a true American folk right. You couldn't see guys in Italy doing this between the halves of a soccer game. It just doesn't, you know, it's just not Italian. And I used to play, and by the way, to answer a question, some guy wrote a comment here recently in a review, something about the fact that how could I have played in the band and at the same time played football? Well, I have to explain that. In the conference where I played football, we were only allowed to play varsity ball from our sophomore year on. Many conferences are like that, as you know, Herb. And I played only in my freshman year in the marching band. But 1 year is a lifetime. I mean, since I played freshman ball, we played our ball games, football. We played our ball games Saturday afternoon, whereas all of our varsity games were played Friday night. They were all night games. And so once you've marched in a great mass band and know all the fantastic intricacies of making a formation, have you ever watched, when you watch these formations, you realize what goes into doing them. It occurred to you what a thing is going on in the guy's head as he's attempting to play, by the way, the second chorus of Semper Fidelis, which is a real you-know-what buster. And he's blown away there. And at the same time, he's got these patterns in his mind. 1, 2, 3, left diagonal, 1, 2, 3, to the right diagonal, 1, 2, 3, whoop, diagonal, whoop, 40-yard line, 1, 2, 3. It's all going on at the same time. And here you've got this gigantic organization all working out, 115 guys out on the field. And the lights are flashing, people are cheering. And most of the guys in the stands aren't even watching, which is part, it's always true of any art form. I mean, you know, how many guys go to see a Picasso exhibit unless Joe Namath is there to sign autographs? So art is always unsung, and it's time. And I have a thing here. I say that the appreciation of the arts of our time are spreading from the West Coast East. It used to be, years ago, that the East recognized art forms. But the East is always relating itself to Europe. The East is constantly looking for more Brecht to lay on us. It's constantly looking for another new Russian novel to spring on us. And we're relating ourselves to Europe constantly, whereas the West Coast is relating itself to something else entirely. And so out in the West Coast, you know, already art critics have begun to see that one of the great, probably lasting monuments of our time are going to be these enormous, fantastic, and beautiful, by the way, from the air, these tremendous concrete clover leaves of the Turnpike. They're going to have a great aesthetic quality to them if you've ever looked at them the right way. You've seen them, Herb, from the air. They really are spectacular, these enormous, great flowers. They look like great flowers from the air, tremendous geographical petals that just arch out and loop around. And they've already begun to recognize this in the art pages of various West Coast newspapers, where they will actually review a turnpike as an aesthetic experience. We always look at it as some kind of an evil monster. Say, you know, it's the Robert Moses syndrome. But nevertheless, one day, 1,000 years from now, I suspect they may preserve great turnpike interchanges as a mysterious monument from the 20th century, you know, 20 centuries back, just like the pyramids, and it'll be overgrown with great rank weeds. Look like the pyramids in the Mayan country. and stretching to the sky. And at one time, they were useful and functional. People came, and, you know, they did actual sacrifices on them. I mean, they used them. And they were working pyramids. Now, of course, now today, we're doing daily sacrifices on the highways, the same thing. They're working away. And one day, they're going to say, look at that, fantastic. Those people are amazing. Do you realize they did this with primitive equipment? It's hard to believe they could have done this. And there'll be great arguments as to how we discovered this certain kind of circle. And some idiot is going to come up and say, do you realize they're all pointed directly towards the second star to the left from Arcturus Ventura 3? Now, this probably means, and there'll be mysticism develop over it. Well, here is an example of an art column. Listen to this now, from the Los Angeles Times. And it's entitled, The Big Game as Art. An exhibition on a 100-yard canvas. And it's written by the art critic of the Los Angeles Times, William Wilson. And this is a serious art critique column. And it says it for all of us. If someone had attached a leaky paint can to every player in Saturday's USC-UCLA football game, the field would have eventually resembled a painting by Jackson Pollock. People who love and revere football profess not to understand Jackson Pollock's paintings, even though both are demonstrations of power, power tuned to the pitch of balletic hysteria.
The band is directed by Conrad Hutchinson, Jr. Your drum major is Herman Kemp, assisted by Albert and Christopher Robinson.
And he says, and then, of course, there's the halftime. Here they come out. 80,000 people ringing this fantastic arena. And there's a silver blimp hanging 2,000 feet above it all with flashing lights and roaring crowds. And it's being seen by endless, countless billions and trillions watching on their Sylvania color sets from coast to coast, all glued to this fantastic tribal folk rite. Several East Coast art aesthetic aestheticians insisted on traditionally accepted forms of art, theater, dance, concerts, and painting are not native Southern California art. They insist the best reflections of our original culture are massive, unself-conscious phenomena like amusement parks, vehicle races, and sports. I find in this a suggestion that we are viewed as some species today of latter-day Roman, avid for art that is sensual, spectacular, exciting, materialistic, and totally convincingly real. Do you realize, have you ever thought of us as latter-day Romans? Complete with vandals, barbarians, and the works. The proposition was hard to poo-poo when USC's gigantic marching band descended the eastern steps of the Colosseum in Saturday's dusk beneath the conflagration erupting from the colossal Olympic torch. He says they came marching down to the great roar of the crowds, an Olympic torch roaring high over the Colosseum, and the band came down in symbolic lines out of the dusk. An armed and enormously muscled centurion led the Maroon Legion between huge, fluttering yellow banners. The band, which marched like an old silent newsreel, blared triumphal flourishes that Cecil B. DeMille would have thought unbelievable as they came roaring out of the dusk. A centurion then galloped astride a white charger, his flexing jaw muscles visible at 25 yards. When he thumped his armor in Roman salute, the crowd roared with a fantastic bellow. Did you see that on TV? The centurion was so far into his thing that it was easy to fantasize a short story about him putting on his helmet and armor every morning, game or no game. He was a centurion. USC style, viewed from the infield, was tough, arrogant, and polished. In true Roman style, tough, arrogant, and polished. That's USC. It may well be that the central image of the event was a car observed outside, an enormous black Cadillac convertible, an open can of Burgi resting on the seat, and a brown bag. USC's devastatingly beautiful cheerleaders looked like mechanized New Realism sculptures. They were immortally 19, always 19, always young, always beautiful, timelessly pumping pom-poms in controlled Dionysian frenzy, nymphs sublimating simulated eroticism into patriotic passions for the alma mater itself. Fantastic piece. If I'd been UCLA, if I'd been UCLA, I'd have tossed in the towel right then at this tremendous display. And then USC's outraged kitsch Roman Las Vegas style ought to have been funny. They're frenzied chanting, one after the other, "We're number one! We're number one!" roared with a great bellow from one end of the stadium to the other. "We're number one" ought to have been tempered with some edge of camp irony. I couldn't detect any at all. They meant it. It was spooky. And then UCLA's black and white uniform band came out. It looked downright ecclesiastical. There was religious overtones to this band, as opposed from the Dionysian Roman quality of the USC crowd. UCLA, their cheerleaders had a more medieval sort of beauty. Varied in size and color, they shivered when it got cold, fudged some tricks, and seemed to be thinking vaguely about midterms. There was a curious quality of absenteeism about their eyes. The Westwood team wore pastel yellow and blue. That's UCLA, in case you're curious. They wore pastel yellow and blue with gold helmets, colors reminiscent of poetic new lyric painting. You couldn't scare a butterfly with those uniforms. USC's, however, colors took on a Finnish fetish voodoo quality, contrasting lacy cardinal mesh tops with yellow numerals that shone like patent leather under the glancing blue lights. The infield resembled a Fellini film full of pageantry, caricature, and irony. Down there, you can literally hear players mashing. Breath escapes in solid moves. The bruised and terrified face of a downed player suddenly stares at you for a fleeting instant as 200 pounds of flying flesh knocks him out of bounds and he disappears under a bench. Gimlet-eyed photographers jostle for position along the sidelines. They never smile. A wooden chariot moves the all-seeing eye of the majestic television camera at a stately pace. Television is the eternal god of these events. Why does the crowd roar in the wrong places? I don't know. A man has just been severely bashed and is carried out on a stretcher, and 90,000 people roar their approval. The crowd has the advantage, of course, of aesthetic distance. They don't see his twisted knee and the pain in his eyes. Halfway up the stands, the field assumes a generic resemblance to abstractions. Sitting way at the top, the field has a curious abstract quality, like pool tables or pinball machines. Distance allows spectators an aura of intellectual detachment. Players are dehumanized by hard, heraldic colors, mechanical numerals, and helmeted heads. They appear as fictional demi-humans acting out a fantasy about competitive machismo. And all the while, those 19 majestic, fantastic girls keep moving up and down and jiggling in a strange, mesmeric quality. A football game is about gangs of men assaulting one another. Normally, of course, that's against the law. Society makes the activity acceptable by acting on it as an artist acts on his raw canvas, his playing field. Yes. The society as artist transforms assault through organization, control, beautification, and intellectualization. It becomes a metaphor of acceptable and traditional values. Thus, the blonde with the china blue porcelain eyes, those lovely porcelain eyes screaming, "Kill, kill, kill," was affirming the values of loyalty to one's school, team cooperation, and winning inside the system. She could not be booked for inciting a riot, even though she was calling for mayhem. Yes, football is unquestionably an art form, spawned by the collective needs of some part of the society. Yet, it hardly seems fair for us to claim it as a native California art. It really belongs as much to the East Coast and the Midwest and the South with their more entrenched sense of tradition. In fact, let's face it, the Saturday afternoon football game, and in particular, the majestic halftime ceremonies, are a true all-American art. They cover the entire nation. It evokes autumn leaves, fraternity reunions, the novels of John P. Marquand, and the current traditional revivalist trend of the culture in general. By the way, you're listening to one of the top bands in the country right now. You ever seen these guys perform? That's the Grambling College Band. Incidentally, to show you, hold it there a minute, Herb. I'll tell you, maybe you haven't kept abreast of this. Do you know that this has become so important in the schools now? I'm talking about the whole panoply of football. We all know about football players being recruited. But do you know that today they recruit sousaphone players? And they recruit drum majorettes, they recruit pom-pom girls. If a chick is seen doing a fantastic thing in the middle of a halftime game, let's say between Clifton High and, let's say, Raspberry Park or a garbage field, which are generic forms of approbation in Jersey. How many of you know where garbage field is? What is garbage field over in Jersey, right? Do you know? Oh, of course. Right, right. And where's Raspberry? Do I have to ask you? Well, if a chick is seen who comes out with this tremendous a charisma in the halftime, instantly five scouts descend on her from the Big Ten, from the Little Eight, from the Purple, the Big Three. And that's the truth. And so today it's not uncommon for a kid, who's a really top-flight pivot, a pivot marcher in the sousaphone section, to get offers from 9-10 schools. And I can see him sitting back there, with his B-flat, his double B-flat sousaphone, and he's, cooling it in the high school cafeteria, and these guys are coming around. Hey, listen, kid, you haven't signed with USC yet, have you? I'm going to talk to your mother and father. Listen, how would you like to have your own silver con double B-flat horn, your own? I mean, it won't belong to the school. We'll lay one on you. Not only that, we'll see that you get yourself a Vega convertible, and we'll give you a nice job, like handing out, how about a job like handing out mouthpieces to the French horn section at $20 an hour, huh? Put in 4 or 5 hours of that doing a day, and the kid's thinking about it, because this has become a major thing today. And in fact, if a school fails in its halftime show, and they switch to an interview with Frank Gifford interviewing a halfback, that means you've really blown it. You've really blown it. They do, and that the networks wait, see, and they wait to see how the halftime show is going. And if the halftime show is a real dud, you'll hear Chris Schenkel saying, "And now, folks, we know that you'd all like to see the campus of Pitcairn University, and we filmed some highlights of the magnificent campus on the shores of the Monongahela River, and now we take you by film to beautiful Pitcairn University." That means that band director is going to be looking for a job in 5 minutes. And it's really down to him on the field. He's there, he's directing, and the pom-pom chicks are going. And somebody says, "TV just went off. They've got a damn film, for God's sakes, a film." And you can just see him droop, because they've blown their national audition. And it's just like trying to get a show. It's like any artist. If he tries to get a show at the Museum of Modern Art, and they send his stuff back and say, "How come you didn't send us a return envelope with this junk?" Well, he walks around and he drags his tail. And I think that the changing thing that has happened in the halftime shows is that the halftime shows no longer have much to do with marching. They celebrate various national events and various national phenomena, which are not celebrated in any other area. For example, a couple of weeks ago, I heard this this announcer. You might have seen the game. It says, "And now, the great purple band takes this occasion to salute one of the major doctors of our time. We are now going to, as our halftime show, our fantastic salute to Dr. Marcus Welby." And they marched out and they formed a gigantic hypodermic needle. Well, now, this is symbolic in many ways. Did you see the one that saluted poverty recently? Imagine this band out there saluting poverty. How are they salute? I mean, it's like saluting cold sores. I mean, and they saluted poverty. Well, of course, all these kids were going to this swacky rich college, you know, and they're saluting poverty. Well, I suppose if you're at the top of the ladder, it's kind of nice to know that there are people at the bottom of the ladder who wants everybody to climb up there with you. So they saluted poverty. And you know how they saluted poverty? It's kind of nice. And you see, didn't you see what they formed, the band formed when it was saluting poverty? Did you see that? You didn't see that? Well, why is it I'm the only one that sees this kind of Americana? I'm not going to tell you. It's the only thing I've got that this. Well, all right, I'll ask you a question here. Did you see the other day when they saluted the war on crime? One of these bands came out and says, "We're going to salute the war on crime." But what do you think they had? These guys made a gigantic police special. They formed a big 38 out there in the field. Didn't you see it? That's right. And it says, you know, support your local police. And I thought that was kind of nice. They marched around, made little squares and triangles, and then they made a big blackjack. And then a bunch of kids came out, they're dressed like thugs, and they were chased across the field by a guy symbolically dressed as police. It was really great, you know, and they had barking dogs. Did you hear that? It's terrific. And I say that this is an art form that that has not yet been fully recognized as such. Oh yeah, didn't you see the other day when they had during the halftime of a football game, they had these police dogs out there. Did you see that one? And they had a guy dressed like a mugger, and he came out and he mugged this lady. It was another cop dressed like a lady. She's walking along, she's pushing a baby carriage, and he came out and he starts to mug her. He said, "Give me that purse." And with that, they let the dog go. And he goes, "Ah, ah, ah, ah." He came out and I'll tell you, tore the guy's arm right off, and the people cheered. And the announcer said, "And now, once again, we salute the majestic police dogs of the nation, which are standing in vigilance and watchfulness everywhere, protecting you as you go through Central Park. Just make sure you come equipped. You're liable to lose one of your ankles." But nevertheless, this major art form, which I think is growing by leaps and bounds, should be recognized. Should be recognized. The 100-yard canvas. Have you ever thought of the canvas, that the field is a 100-yard piece of canvas, and we make these fantastic images as the guy gallops down the sidelines dressed as a Roman centurion in a magnificent costume? Did you see the costume with the fantastic white horse and the crowd cheering and the pom-pom girls moving up and down, all those bazooms going up and down in symbolic Dionysian rhythms? How are you, Dionysius? Pretty good times these days. This is WOR New York. You stay tuned for Lester Smith and the news.
This is the news in detail on the hour from the WOR newsroom. No sign of any settlement in the Long Island Railroad strike. After the talks aimed at breaking the impasse recessed for the day, union leader Anthony DeVanzo reported no progress. New York City's Deputy Mayor Edward Hamilton urged the negotiators to begin round-the-clock talks. Hamilton called on Governor Rockefeller to help solve the dispute. Meanwhile, all on the side of the street parking regulations will remain suspended in Brooklyn and Queens tomorrow as a result of the strike. But all other parking regulations will remain in effect throughout the five boroughs, and that's worth repeating, since a number of people have taken the idea that because of the strike emergency, there are no regulations in effect. All parking regulations are in effect, except for the suspension of alternate side of the street regulations, but only in Brooklyn and Queens. Starting tomorrow morning, there'll be special bus service on the Jerusalem Avenue line. Buses will pick up between 6:45 and 8:45 a.m. at two locations, the Merrick Railroad Station, the Seaford Railroad Station. Service will terminate in Jamaica at 169th Street and Hillside Avenue. Going home from Jamaica between 4 and 7:30 p.m., the buses will stop at all Long Island Railroad stations between Jamaica and Merrick. The negotiations to settle the strike, which have been taking place at the International Hotel at Kennedy Airport, have been no picnic for newsmen, as WR's Burt Wilson reports.
Principals in the Long Island Railroad and the 12 Union Striking Coalition have both agreed that news blackouts that they had agreed upon before will be out as of tomorrow morning. The embargo on news had prevented reporters from local and major stations from reporting any of the latest developments in the strike. It was not until newsmen assigned to the talks here at the International Hotel heard Union Coalition spokesman Anthony DiAvanzo live on the air telling the whole story to a local station that a protest was registered to both sides. That embargo has been dropped, and as a result, news of whatever progress is made in the strike will be aired to the public. The threat by John Mahoney, leader of a Teamster Union 808, to defect from the 12 Union Coalition to do his own bargaining for some 1,000 members has failed to materialize. According to DiAvanzo, Mahoney is back in the fold. A union meeting tonight killed any chance of such a defection taking place. At the International Hotel, this is Bert Wilson.
New York City police are searching for four prisoners who escaped from the back of a Department of Correction van today. The four are among 26 prisoners being transported from the Bronx courthouse to the Bronx House of Detention. They escaped when the van stopped due to mechanical trouble on Exterior Street, just behind the detention facility. Two of the four escapees were said to have been handcuffed together when they boarded the van. One of the four was charged with receiving stolen property, the other three with robbery. We'll have more news after this. It's free golf and family fun, holiday vacation time at Mickey Rooney's Downingtown Inn. 3, 4, 5 days or more of unlimited free golf or free skiing and gourmet dining luxury from only $49 per person, double occupancy complete.